following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. Before I welcome our guest today, I would be remiss if I didn't make a couple announcements, one good and one not so much. First, this is the 13th anniversary here on WHFR Radio. As I do every year, I want to thank the station for providing a platform with which to present researchers and UFO witnesses from around the country and indeed the world to present their evidence of the UFO reality. I want to thank those guests, and a special thanks to you, the loyal listener, for tuning in and going to the archives every month, and without you, the show would have been canceled long ago. So please keep on keeping on. And now on a more solemn note, ufology has lost one of its founding fathers. Nuclear physicist Stanton T. Friedman has passed away at the age of 84. He died doing what he loved most, sharing the UFO reality with others. He was on his way from, on his way home to Fredericton, Ontario, Canada, from a speaking engagement in Ohio, when he died suddenly on Monday, May 13th, 2019, at Toronto's Pearson International Airport. Without Stan's persistence and thorough investigation, the world would still believe that a weather balloon had crashed in the desert near Roswell, New Mexico, back in 1948. He was famous for books on Roswell and others, some co-authored by Kathleen Marden, who was on this show just a couple months ago. And the world will miss him as well as I, and may he rest in peace as he explores the heavens. So now a more appealing subject, today's guest. Jennifer Stein was on the show back in September of 2016. If our listeners will recall, she produced the excellent documentary Travis, the true story of Travis Walton. Of course, he's the subject of the book and the movie Fire in the Sky. Jennifer is a filmmaker, a researcher, writer, and entrepreneur, as well as state section director for Pennsylvania MUFON. She holds a BS in textiles from the University of Arizona and has held numerous leadership and board positions for several educational and nonprofit organizations in the Philadelphia area. Jennifer had her first UFO encounter in 1975, which stimulated her deep curiosity to learn more about the field. She has spoken around the United States, Canada, and France, and on specialty UFO cruises on her crop circle research and ancient archaeology studies. Jennifer has appeared on numerous international radio networks discussing her award-winning films and her research on crop circles. And we're pleased to have her on today, back on the show, on the anniversary show, that is. So welcome to the show, Jennifer.
Thank you so much, David, for hosting me, and congratulations to you. It's nice to have an anniversary of a special group you've organized. Yeah. I'm going on 18 years here in Philadelphia with my little educational group called Mainline MUFON, which I host.
Oh.
It's free educational programs in the Philadelphia area, so anyone listening who's interested in educational programs in the Philadelphia area, they should look up Mainline MUFON.
Mainline MUFON. Now, is this on radio, or is this...
No, it's literally live and in person. So I bring in speakers, and we have presentations, PowerPoint presentations that run about an hour and a half with Q&A, and then a whole group go out to a diner and talk till about midnight. You know, the typical thing that always happens around UFO conferences and UFO events is that people get talking and they need to keep talking, so they go to a local diner at about 9 o'clock, and we're usually there till midnight talking. It's really special, and we've been doing this for actually, I took over a group that Bob Urey founded. Bob was a professor teaching UFOs at Temple University, and he did a program in my local community for 20 years. And then when he stopped, I basically took over and started doing programs, and I've been doing it almost 20 years now, about 18.
Wow.
And it's a really great group. We get about 50, 60 people on a regular basis. It's like a mini conference that happens once a month. And it's free. I don't charge anything for it. I pay the speaker's expenses to come in, but I don't necessarily give them an honorarium. They're usually willing to come for free.
Mm-hmm.
And on special occasions, like when I hosted Stanton Friedman, we did charge because we couldn't do it at the library for free. We had to rent a bigger facility,
right.
So I had to charge for that.
Mm-hmm.
But
Stan was here at the college. Henry Ford College, I can't tell you the year now, but quite a few years ago, I had the honor of chauffeuring him around, picking him up at the airport and taking him to his hotel and over here to the college and what have you. So
he's such a special man. He really was.
Certainly.
And he made such a contribution to the world. He really encouraged a whole generation of ufologists and writers. He inspired writers and researchers galore, including, you know, me. I felt very, very grateful to have the experiences I did with Stanton. I actually was producing a television pilot in 2008, which got green-lighted and then quickly got canceled with Sci-Fi.
Oh my.
But it was called... that's when Sci-Fi went through a reorganization of their finances, and they changed their spelling of their name.
Oh, yeah.
And they changed the format of a lot of their programs. That's when Ghost Hunters and things like that, you know, came up on their station. A lot of more simply produced programming,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of more, I don't know what you would call them, life story, encounters and reactionary programs. I think that honestly the programming went down, but they had to come up with a way to do things cheaper.
Yeah.
But we had launched a pilot with them called First Contact, and it was Stanton Friedman, Richard Dolan, and Peter Robbins traveling around the country in an RV investigating UFOs. And the first pilot we did was around the 1952 and 2002 UFOs over the White House. That's how we thought we'd start, you know, really dive into the fundamental secrecy that was established in the government, you know, around 1949 to 1952. That's when the whole, what I call the codification of secrecy came into being, and the Robertson panel and, you know, the closing down of Project Sign and Project Grudge and Project Twilight, which Edward Ruppelt worked on, and then the official establishment of Project Blue Book, which is a farce to begin with.
That's the one I like to call Project Whitewash.
Yeah, Project Whitewash. Project Blue Book was, it could have just as well been called Project Whitewash.
Yeah.
Actually, you really know it when you see the name Project Grudge, because that's when everything changed. That was around 1949, according to Edward Ruppelt, when you read his book. Of course, he was the first one within the military that was assigned to research these things. And in fact, it was because of Stanton that I learned about Edward Ruppelt and his book and the inside workings of the Air Force before it was an Air Force, basically the Army Air Corps,
right,
and the Air Intelligence Command groups and what they were seeing. All, they came up right after the atomic bomb, from 1947 to 1949. Everybody in the government who was chasing and following and researching UFOs, they all got that they were real and they were from another planet. And when Edward Ruppelt went out and talked about it, nobody questioned whether or not it was real or not. Mm-hmm. He spoke before heads of state and groups of, military execs, and nobody raised their hand and said, "What, are you a nut? Are you a fool? What are you saying?
Yeah, that's what gets me about the entire phenomenon. Back in those days, they admitted, I don't know where they're from, but they're out there,
that's right.
They're not ours. And then all of a sudden, no, just a weather balloon, and anybody who sees them's got to be crazy.
Go ahead
and ridicule them. And now it's come full circle again.
Right, that's right. And that's really what Stanton is really known for, because he saw the handwriting on the wall just in terms of the documentation that was put out. Mm-hmm. That's why he republished some of the original Blue Book files, which he had gotten, which had completely different statistics and numbers than those that were published publicly for the, he found stuff in archives that was not in the public publications.
Yeah.
So he found the discrepancies and said, no, it's not 3% that are unexplained, it's 30% that are unexplained.
Right, right.
So he really was an archivist, and he really inspired future archivists himself. And he definitely inspired me.
Yeah.
I got to go into the Philadelphia Philosophical Society right here in Center City. I hosted Stanton a couple times with Kathy Martin, and we went down and researched things, each in line with what we were individually researching. Like, Kathy was interested in the archives with Donald Menzel and also with Philip Klass, because Philip Klass tried to buy the audio tapes from her niece.
Mm-hmm.
Her aunt, right, from Betty Hill, because he wanted to debunk the Betty and Barney Hill story.
Right.
So he went after Dr. Simon trying to get the original tapes.
Mm-hmm.
So she was archiving and researching Philip Klass's file, and so was Stanton. They were writing a book, I think, at that point. That might have been Fact and Fiction of Flying Saucers, probably.
Or who was writing the book?
Both Stanton and Kathy wrote a book.
Was that was Captured?
They wrote Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers. They wrote Captured. They wrote a couple of different books together.
I think
all together they published maybe five books together, five or six.
Yeah.
In the period of time that they wrote together. So I got to go into the archives with Stanton and Kathy. I mean, what better teachers to have with me? And, of course, I was working on the Travis Project. So they were, as we were reading files, when you go into an archive, you figure out how much is there. Like, there's so many feet of documents. Like, they say 12 feet or 8 feet or 10 feet,
mm-hmm,
or 10 shelves or 12 shelves or something. And you ask them, and then it's organized by who the correspondence was with, usually.
Right.
So usually what you do is you ask them to bring up the whole shelf, and then you go through the files yourself. But that can take a week or 2 weeks to go through 10 feet of documents,
Yeah, well, nobody could do the digging like Stanton.
That's
Friedman.
That's right. Stanton really, I really got to have an inside view what goes in to really digging into an archive. Because once you find documentation in an archive, that's yours, that's your gold. Yeah, that's your cinder block you can stand on. And if somebody's going to come after you and accuse you of not knowing what you're talking about, you can say, well, actually, here's a copy of the documentation,
mm-hmm,
in the archive.
Mm-hmm.
You can go look it up for yourself, and you can interpret it any way you want.
Right.
And that's what I loved about Stanton. he never put himself above anybody else. And he, I have to give him credit, if you don't mind me continuing to sing his praises.
Certainly.
He actually was responsible for writing and producing a documentary film in 1978 with a producer named Brandon Chase in California in 1978. And this never made it to movie theaters or to any kind of mainstream, production facility where people could see it. It's actually on different YouTube sites now, probably illegally posted. But it was called UFOs, I think UFOs Over Earth. And it had the Travis Walton story, the Betty and Barney Hill story, and then it went into an in-depth understanding of Wendell Stevens and his research and his experiences. So it was these three main people that were covered. Mm-hmm. So I had wonderful immediate access to archive material on Travis Walton's case. You know, archive footage of even Stanton Friedman, who appeared in the film back in the 1980s, being interviewed in his office, I think in Stanford at the time, where he lived and worked in California, I think for General Dynamics. So it was wonderful, to have him really as an associate producer on the Travis film, really helping me and guiding me, having good archival data. And unfortunately, that contact ended up not working out, and I had to buy other archive footage. But I was so grateful to Stanton for opening those doors, providing me with emails, guiding me, contacting me, reading through outlines of the script I'd written and making suggestions about how better to put the material together and certain things not to make claims about because I couldn't particularly back them up, right. But to approach it a slightly different way that enabled the audience, not to beat the audience over the head with the information because the audiences are smart. Let them figure it out. Just give them the information and let them put the pieces of the puzzle together.
Yeah, let them go do their own digging.
Exactly.
Well, it's a shame that didn't make your show did not make it onto TV. But at the same time, they started having UFO documentaries on Sci-Fi, and I thought, I don't know. That's not such a good station to have UFOs document.
You're absolutely right, because if it's put through a science fiction network, then people are going to look at it and think, well, is this science fiction or is this real?
But now, Unidentified, for example, History Channel.
Right, that's right.
God bless them. We've
come a long way in the last 15 years, haven't we?
That's right. So I noticed History Channel, Discovery, Travel Channel. Travel Channel does a lot of ghosts and hauntings and things like that. But I don't know if you're into that, but the paranormal.
Well, you know what? I appreciate the fact that we are expanding our understanding of consciousness.
Right.
And we know so little and have not really researched or studied our full approach to really understanding the nature of consciousness. Mm-hmm. There's way too much in terms of paranormal experiences, certainly around death and dying situations, that we have yet to fully understand. And that may very well overlap into higher intelligence species who function in different brainwave categories or different
dimensions.
But dimensions or vibrational states where they can communicate with us or come in and out of our dimensional space.
Right.
And it's all about vibratory frequencies and resonance fields. And we're beginning to understand that more and more. And, of course, the role that magnetics plays in the physical nature of the physical universe.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very strong part of our memory, of our consciousness, of our understanding of what gravity is, of our place physically on this earth. So there are so many areas yet to fully open in future sciences that we have only yet begun to scratch the surface with. So even though we categorize them in very different fields now, like ghosts and hauntings and aliens and good ET experiences and bad ET experiences and life after death and,
communicating.
near-death experiences where people come back to life after being dead.
Right.
It's all separated now, but I think these areas of study are really a future interdisciplinary approach for a major university to be brave enough to undertake. And I don't know if you noticed or saw this in the news recently, but Penn State University is dedicating, I think, a building and a department and a chair towards a whole PhD program that you can get, as well as an undergraduate program, on the potential of extraterrestrial life in the greater universe and our ability to communicate and with that extraterrestrial life and then eventually travel to other planets, and what that engagement should look like on a sociological, political, religious, financial, economic, you know, perspective, how we should begin engagement. I mean, they are taking it seriously.
Yes. And a lot of colleges are, you know, Duke University was the first to dabble in the spiritual and psychic areas.
Ah.
Yeah.
Well, I know Stanford did some of that work, too, but I did not know about Duke.
Duke was the first. And I didn't know about Stanford, but, I mean, several universities, several colleges are following suit. And maybe I can get them to do it over here. Henry Ford. You know?
Right.
So, speaking of which, I must take a minute just to remind our listeners, you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone on 89.3 FM, or WHFR.FM on your computer. And I'm David Twitchell on We Are Not Alone, and we're speaking with filmmaker and entrepreneur Jennifer Stein. So many hats you wear, Jennifer.
I do.
You do.
I do.
We'll just wrap it up as to researcher, UFO researcher.
Perfect.
Yeah. But we're talking about the paranormal as to ghosts. Now, I don't consider, you know, a lot of people consider UFOs to be in the paranormal, you know, because it's strange, it's weird. Well, I don't consider it as paranormal. Like, you don't normally see a UFO, okay? But
right.
I think, I know that UFOs are normal. They're just rare, okay?
Right.
And, but back to the ghosts and that type of paranormal that they have on the Travel Channel, I've been having a lot of guests on this show that dabble into that are strictly ghosts and hauntings and what have you, and trying to make that connection between the spiritual plane and UFOs, and you know, I always believed that was a physical thing, the UFOs, physical from another planet. But why not other dimensional, you know? Why not other dimensional and just like spiritual phenomenon? Am I right?
You know, have you ever heard of James Gilliland?
Oh, yes. We had him on the show.
Right. Well, the way he began his whole experience, of course, he had a major awakening with a life after death experience where, you know, a near death experience. He had an NDE where he was pronounced dead from a surfing accident, right, where he drowned and he was dragged up on the beach and resuscitated, and his life changed dramatically at that point. He was suddenly aware of other dimensions and very psychic. And a number of years later, he was meditating, connecting in with these higher conscious beings that were literally communicating with him and guiding him in meditation. Mm-hmm. And one day he asked them, where exactly are you communicating with me from? You know, like he just posed the question in his meditation. And the answer was, well, since you've asked, actually, we're in a ship above you. We're in a craft sitting above you, above the earth plane. And he thought he'd made this up. And he thought, oh, I've totally lost it, right? And he brought himself out of the meditation. At the same moment, his two sisters ran in from outside and said, James, there's a UFO sitting above the house! You know, and that's when he realized, oh my, this is a strange universe. This is this is not what I expected.
And there's the connection, right?
And there's the connection. Yeah. Absolutely. So he was very brave to really come forward about that. There's a wonderful documentary film any of the listeners can watch, and I'm sure you promoted this when you had James on, but it's called Contact Has Begun. And as a documentary filmmaker, I appreciate when a body of work goes into a documentary that really communicates, A to Z understanding, I'll say, you know, a soup to nuts understanding of his life experience and how it now overlaps into really being able to consciously call in light beings and light ships and, you know, whether it's a benevolent and advanced species of beings that exist in another dimensional plane or whether they're actually physical beings like you and I, we just can't, you know, completely see them, interact with them. I'm not sure, but on his ranch, you can go and camp and stay. I think it's near Mount Adams or Mount Hood not too far from Seattle, I think, in Washington State. Mm-hmm. And you can go and you know, camp out and have an experience. He runs actually a conference every July. Forget the name of what he calls it. Something like ET, UFO consciousness, or something like that.
Yeah, I have to get back with him. He's communicated with me a couple times. I communicated. Okay, through email, not
right.
Psychically.
Not psychically, right, right. But I have a huge amount of respect for James as well, and I think he's doing a really great job at demystifying this overlap, like you're saying, that exists.
Right.
And when you can even see this in the Travis film, I know you invited me on, of course, to speak about the Travis Walton documentary and my involvement with it. But anyone, you know, really fully reading Travis's book or seeing the documentary and understanding it, Travis has fully come full circle as well, understanding that he probably was killed accidentally by getting too close to this craft in the forest. And these beings had a sense of responsibility that they accidentally probably killed him because stupid Travis ran right up underneath this UFO as it was probably trying to take off.
Right.
And it built up some sort of static charge. And when Travis was in a crouch or a crunching on his knees or kneeling, squatting, trying to hide behind a slash pile of wood that was going to be burned, he jumped up, and at the moment he jumped up, he kind of maybe triggered something accidentally from the craft that was a reaction,
right.
Hit him with this beam or bolt of electrical force that threw him as if he was hit by a grenade, and it probably killed him. So once the crew members were frightened and took off, these beings probably picked him up, brought him on board the ship. He was gone 5 days, and they probably brought him back to life and repaired him and then returned him right outside of Heber 5 days later. It's really an incredible story.
It is. I watched that video. It's a great documentary. Tell our listeners where they can go to
To see it. Well, there's a couple new things which have developed since the film first came out. They of course can go to Travis's website, which is traviswalton.com, or they can go to traviswaltonthemovie.com, and they can literally buy a DVD there if they're interested.
Mm-hmm.
We are still selling the first version of the film that we put out in a DVD format, which I truly believe will become a collector's item because it has some of this contested film footage in it that I mentioned to you before, that Stanton Friedman was able to connect me into this early producer who got me early rights to this footage, but then he changed his mind and said I couldn't put it in a theater or put it on, you know, on the World Wide Web or stream it or anything with this footage in it. But he said nothing about DVDs. So I used it and put it into a DVD because he never contested that. And so that'll become a collector's item. And we'll stop selling that shortly. For the 45th anniversary, we're launching the newest version of the film, which has a better animated section when describing everything that happened on board the craft with Travis. Mm-hmm. We literally physically went into a studio and reshot this with actors, and then we softened it so it doesn't look like it's too animated for people, because of course we had to create the creatures with CGI mm-hmm. that Travis interacts with. And so the newest version has that 15-minute, or maybe it's a 12-minute section in the middle of the film where he describes what happened on board the craft. It has that in it, and it has new polygraph examiners looking at the footage from a 40-year perspective as opposed to a 20-year perspective, which the first film had an expert, Edward Gelb, talking about that. And, of course, we interviewed Leo Sprinkle and David Jacobs, and we just added in some more interviews that were not in the original film. And that will be released. It's actually out now on Amazon. People can go to Amazon and Google the true story of Travis Walton. They can find the film and they can stream it and watch it on Amazon. And pretty soon, through a distributor I'm using in California, it should be available under another title. This is an interesting story I can share with you, but we're putting it out under the title Alien Abduction. And it should be available maybe within a couple of months, 3-4 months, on Hulu and Netflix and, YouTube and all these various streaming channels that are out there. Mm-hmm. There's some lesser subtitle, UFO streaming networks and things like that that will also pick it up. But the reason I'm relaunching it under the new title is I kind of learned reading like film distribution books and streaming distribution guidelines for filmmakers that if your film starts with the letter A, or one title in the film starts with the letter A, you appear first in the list.
Oh, sure.
And your film does 80% better.
Is that right? Yeah.
And I'm like, what? I like hit myself in the head, like, why didn't somebody tell me that 5 years ago, right?
You should call it triple A abductions.
Right.
That's what
the first name and the second name will have it. So it's Alien Abduction, and then the subtitle is The True Story of Travis Walton. So if somebody's already watched it, hopefully they'll see the subtitle and they'll get it. They'll go, oh, I already saw it. But, it's a slightly newer version, and I think it'll stream for different prices. In some places it's like $1.99, in other places it's like $3 or $4. But,
just
I'm hoping
to it, right?
Still recap some of the, investment money I put into it.
$1.99 just to watch it?
Yeah, I think so, maybe.
Okay.
It depends on, like, if you're on Amazon Prime or something, it might be available there as Alien Abduction as part of your Amazon Prime membership. I'm actually not sure. I haven't read all the fine print yet with the distribution service I'm using, but it's going to be a streamed thing that will be out there, and it'll be under that name as well. And we're launching a new DVD in time for the 45th anniversary, so that'll probably come out next spring. That will be this actual version, this newer version, available on DVD for people who are also collectors and like to have it as a DVD instead of streaming it, or downloading it. They can have it as a DVD.
That's the way I prefer. Now, all of your documentaries and all of your work really should be under one umbrella at your site, shouldn't it?
Well, it is. You can find out about the other documentaries. I have a website for my production company, and that's called On Wings Productions. And if you go to TravisWaltonTheMovie.com, you can link over there. Or if you just go to On Wings Productions, that's spelled O-N-W-I-N-G-E-S Productions. It's actually my maiden name. Wing is a Norwegian name, W-I-N-G-E. So mm-hmm. When I formed a production company, I just decided to use my maiden name and put an O-N on the front and use my name, Wing, and then I just put an S on the back of it because I needed that number of letters when I started email back in 1980.
Oh, yeah.
Something like that. No, I guess no, it was 1989, 1990. When I started actually doing email.
Right.
That's when we all got home computers, right?
Right.
So I didn't know what name to use, and I thought I'd use my maiden name. And since I've just been using that for so many years, I just kept it. So I use the name On Wings.
Very good. On Wings Productions. Now, you were just part of the Pennsylvania MUFON conference held on June 6th and 7th, though,
weren't you? Yes, we just had a great conference. I was not one of the speakers, but I was present to help introduce some of the speakers. And, of course, you know, I wrote a bunch of their bios and welcomed them and ran the schedule and, you know, set up a backdrop, made sure their, you know, projection worked well and things like that. And, you know, made sure the vendor tables were set up. There's always a lot to that goes on in organizing this event. And we have a great team of field investigators here in Pennsylvania that all show up and help. So it was a very successful conference. We ran Friday from about 4 till about 10 at night on Friday afternoon with a couple of speakers and a cocktail gathering where you could meet and greet the speakers. And then we did an event all day Saturday with a banquet dinner and a Q&A at the end of the night.
Is this going to be an annual event?
We have been doing an annual conference here in Pennsylvania ever since, I think, 2004, 2003.
Okay.
So, and I run this organization called Mainline MUFON because when I got involved in Pennsylvania, there really was not an active MUFON group meeting. There were a group of field investigators, but they were far and few between, maybe 3 or 4 in the whole state. And they were disparagingly spread around different parts of the state. And no one was really doing public education and outreach. And that's what I had been doing prior to getting involved with MUFON. And actually, Ruben Uriarte, who's the state director for MUFON in Northern California, he and I took a trip through crop circles together. And I said, Ruben, I want to join a MUFON group. You know, you've talked to me so much on this whole week about MUFON. How can I join one in Pennsylvania? And he said, Jen, you really got to organize one because it's not really functioning. And that was around 2000. So by 2001, I started an educational program. And then by 2002, I named it Mainline MUFON. And before that, it was under the umbrella of Noetic Sciences, founded by Edgar Mitchell.
Oh, okay.
So when I started, there was no, you know, organized state director that was really organizing the field investigators or doing field investigation training and things like that. I think it was Wayne Gracie, who's still very much involved. And then we had John Ventry for a while. Now we have John Duchette, who is our state director.
Yeah, I was. I spoke with. When John Ventry was running the show over there, I spoke at one of the Pennsylvania.
Yes. It was you were probably up at the Sheraton, probably the Sheraton Hotel in Bucks County.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, Bill Konkoleski was on the bill as well.
Uh huh. Yes. Bill's a wonderful guy. I really like him.
Yeah. So let me take one more minute because there's an important question I have to ask you, but I need to break again to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and that's 89.3 FM on your radio dial. And you are listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Jennifer Stein, a filmmaker, and and she is a experiencer as well. You had your own personal experience back in 1975. Can you tell our listeners about that?
Sure. I'd be happy to. I was 19 years old, and it was about 5:30 in the morning. I woke up from a dream, and I was going to grab my journal and write down the dream because I was in an active state of doing that. I had read a book by Edgar Casey, and I was trying to understand my subconscious mind, and I was writing down my dreams to better understand them. So I grabbed my journal. It wasn't quite light out. It was what I call black and white outside. It wasn't... the sun hadn't fully come up yet, but it was starting to come up. But everything was just kind of black and white. It was very early dawn, and I could see what time it was. I had a little clock next to my bed, so I wrote down 5:30 and started to try to write the dream down. And I look outside my bedroom window, and there's an odd thing happening outside. There was a rectangle, sort of white light, that was about a mile and a half away, about on a 45-degree angle off to my right, about a 45-degree from the horizon as well. It was about 1,500 feet to 2,000 feet in the air. And it was about as big as if you were going to hold two quarters end-to-end in your hand at arm's length, you know, between your index finger and your thumb. So most people can hold their finger up, spread their index finger and their thumb, and get a sense of how large it was. And it was odd because I could clearly see it was a rectangle of bright white light. So I assumed, well, it's a plane or something, and that's a reflection, and it'll change as soon as the plane moves, because we've all looked at aerial phenomenon where you see a plane flying and all of a sudden it reflects the sun, right. And for a moment it's like blinding light, but then it moves a little further forward, and then you realize, oh, okay, and then it's in the shadow, and it's an airplane, and you can see it. Or you hear it or something.
Right.
Well, this never moved. It just sat there and sat there and sat there, and I'm trying to think about my dream, and finally I look back at this object, and I just, as a typical teenager would do, I said, you know, what the beep or bleep is that, right? Using a four-letter word. And all of a sudden, at that instant, this object moved very, very quickly, almost as if it jumped in and out of reality, like a stone skipping across water. And it was suddenly outside my bedroom window, less than 500 feet away, about maybe 600 feet, 700 feet in the air, possibly, sitting kind of right above a big tree in my meadow. The tree was about 8 stories high, I'm going to guesstimate, and it was kind of a big rectangle. So this object was about at least 80 to 90 feet long, because you could draw a big rectangle around this tree. And it was one of those big old oak trees, you know, and I just was like stunned by this. It was about 5 or 6 feet high, and it was, again, undulating white, brilliant white light that I thought was going to blind me. But this is where it doesn't make any sense, David. It did not light up the tree. It didn't light up the ground. It didn't light up my house or my bedroom,
right,
or me or anything. It was almost absorbing light. So how is something so bright like that there but not lighting anything up? But yet I thought it was going to blind me.
I saw the
same
thing.
And I went into complete shock, and I was trying to jump up and run out of the room, and I couldn't. And I sat there just weeping and crying, sensing this thing was watching me. I knew something was going on consciously, but I couldn't completely put my finger on what it was because I'd just gone into complete shock. I knew I couldn't even flick an eyelash or move a baby finger. I was just stunned right there, and probably maybe paralyzed or something. Who knows? Maybe it was my own fear that paralyzed me. I wasn't sure. But then I got the mental message that I remember enough, because I eventually journaled this, that it was leaving. And when it took off the same way it came in, jumping in and out of almost existence. Like it disappeared, reappeared, within less than a second. It was like boom, boom, boom. And suddenly it was, again, about a mile and a half away, about 45 degrees on the horizon, in the complete opposite direction in which it had come in from. And it was about, you know, cloud level, I'm going to say about 2,000 feet high. Again, about the same distance. If I held up my arm at arm's length with two quarters, it would block it out. So there again it was in the sky. But at that point, I could jump up. I ran to the window. I grabbed. I had floor-to-ceiling windows, so my hands were on these window panes, looking out at it going, wait a minute. Who are you? What are you? What just happened? Where? What's going on? Where are you from? You know, what did you just, you know, what just transpired here? And I watched it back out of what I'll call reality or the universe or my perspective seeing it. It just doop, 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 and it was gone. And it just got smaller, 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 poof, and gone. But I saw it go behind a couple of clouds in the process of it leaving. So I remember that it was a physical craft that I couldn't see, then I could see, I couldn't see, then I could see, because it moved behind some physical fluffy white, you know, cumulus clouds that were in the sky. So I run into my mother's room. I wake her up. I talk to her about this. I ask her if she saw this event. I'm obviously crying, and I'm kind of hysterical, and I you know how you are when you have a UFO event like this. You're just like petrified, terrified, excited, all these high emotions. She wakes up and looks at me and asks me if I'm on drugs because I'm 19 years old, right? And it's 1975. And I, you know, I said, no, Mom, I'm not on drugs. I went to the bathroom after that. Then I went back into my room and tried to write everything down, except that it was no longer 5:30. That's when I had a real difficult time wrapping my brain around the fact that it was now 7 o'clock and it was light outside.
Mm.
And I was like, no, it's 5:30. This just transpired. It took a matter of what I thought was maybe a minute to 2 minutes at most, and I'd lost an hour and a half of time.
Mm.
So that was the essential core of the experience, which I actually journaled in my journal. And I had my mother to confirm it because, of course, in the middle of the experience, I go and talk to my mother, right?
Right.
But I still didn't know it was real, David, because it could have been some kind of odd, like, dream state. Like, I woke up and I wasn't quite awake and I was sitting up and I dreamt it all. And then I fully woke up and I went and talked to my mother. You know, I mean, I was open to the fact that I didn't really know if it was real.
But
until 25 years later.
This thing had disappeared before you went to wake your mother up.
Talk
right?
to my mother, yeah. Okay. It disappeared. I got up. I went and looked at it, saw it disappear, went in and woke up my mother and talked to her about it.
Okay.
But, of course, all of it transpired in a way in which I thought I was the only objective observer.
Mm-hmm.
But 25 years later, I realized I was not. I had someone else, a good friend, who was staying in my house at the time, who was asleep on another floor of the house on the lower level below me. We had a nice screened-in porch, and he was sleeping out there. And he had the same view I had, just from a few feet lower.
Hmm.
But he saw the whole same thing I did.
Really?
And we never talked about it.
Wow.
Until 25 years later, I go to visit my friend. I'd spent a year on a musical road show with this guy, and we were good friends, and he'd come to visit me. And, you know, he went back to sleep. I went back to sleep after the event happened because I couldn't figure out what had happened to me.
Mm.
We woke up later that day at 10:30, 11 o'clock, right?
Mm.
We went about our day. He had things to do. I had things to do. I was caring for my father was very sick with emphysema, so there was a lot of stress in the house, and I was like the medical advocate and connecting oxygen tanks and running him back and forth to doctor's visits and getting him medication and whatnot. So I can understand why we might not have talked about it. But 25 years later, he asked me, what happened when we had that UFO experience? And I was so freaked out that I said, wait a minute. You go write down your story, and I'll write down mine.
Mm-hmm.
And let's read each other's, because I don't remember you in the picture. I think you were visiting me at the time, and I could verify that from the journal he was, but we never talked about it at the time.
Hmm.
Now, why we never did, I have no idea.
It wasn't time. It wasn't time to talk about it. Yeah.
Maybe I needed time to digest it.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I didn't have the psychological wherewithal to figure out how to put this into perspective.
That often happens with people. It just wasn't time. You don't think about it. Just you forget about it. The day after, you'd think that you'd remember something like that forever.
Right.
You don't. And then
right.
25 years later, hey, you know what? Something switched on, and you remember the entire event.
Well, I was lucky that I had journaled it.
Yeah.
Because I was journaling at the time. And my memory was pretty crisp about it. But I'll tell you, that was a real catalytic event for me, if that's the right word to use. It was a catalyst.
Yeah.
I came home from that event. I visited my friend in Hawaii. And I remember flying home from Hawaii and saying, okay, so what does this mean? Do I just put this experience back in my gray box? Or do I allow it to inform me about the nature of reality and consciousness and my life going forward? And am I curious enough about this to, you know, find somebody to do a regression? You know, what do I want to do about this? How does this change my life? And I just decided I was going to start to go to conferences. I was going to start reading about the subject. I was going to start learning about it. and because it was not in the mainstream. You know, you did not pick up magazines and see articles. I mean, occasionally there was the Betty and Barney Hill article and Life magazine, right? Occasionally you saw things here and there. But pretty much, I mean, Carl Sagan was saying, oh, it's absolutely impossible for life to travel here in 1975.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't know the difference between a debunker and not a debunker, and I was still working my way through college. To a certain extent, having the luxury of being able to really research this practically requires you to be in retirement.
Yeah.
You know?
Really? I found that true.
That's really true, and I think that's why a lot of people kind of move into this field when they finally can take the time and they have the expendable income to start buying books, going to conferences, reading, talking to the experts, learning. Nowadays, it's actually much, much easier than it was in the 70s and 80s and even into the early 90s because of the wealth of material that's online.
Yeah.
But then, on the other hand, it's also very hard because there's so much out there, you have to be very discerning and learn how to go into archives, how to vet the material that you're hearing, and how to be somewhat skeptical because there's so much data out there, it's very hard to know how to sift through it and digest what's real and what's not real.
Sift the wheat from the chaff. I was going to say, as to those lights not illuminating anything, the same thing happened with my sighting, my family's sighting. Bright lights, you know, stadium size lights on this craft. And as bright as they were, it didn't, you know, it was right above treetop level. It never illuminated the ground. And, that's not right, But,
that's interesting, isn't it?
It's that object is in a different time zone than we are. And so that's not uncommon.
And, of course, David, I never heard anything about a rectangular craft. I heard about discs, right?
Right.
If it had been a typical disc, I would have been able to say, oh, well, that's a UFO. But who talked about flying rectangles of white light? I mean, that was so... I just thought I had lost my mind, you know, part of me. I would go back and read this periodically and say, look, did that really happen? I guess it did. I talked to my mother. You know, it was just literally in my gray box, and it bothered me. I mean, periodically I thought about it. Mostly I forgot about it, you know, but you know, and it gradually would pop back up in my frame of reference.
So have you ever had a hypnosis session to bring back what happened?
I did. I finally did with a wonderful man named Joe Lewis, who for a while was head of the Texas MUFON organization in Texas. And he wrote a book called The God Hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
He's a wonderful man, and I just felt like that was the right regression to do. And it's still kind of very strange. You know, regressions are a little difficult to fully wrap your brain around because you're never quite sure of, have I made this up in my imagination, or is it something I'm struggling to connect with or understand? But basically, the gist of the regression was that I had literally asked for some guidance and some help because I was going through a very difficult time in my life with my father dying. My parents were not really on the same page emotionally and psychologically or within the same age range. My father was a good 15 years older than my mother. He was sick and dying from emphysema. My mother was running a number of businesses and working, and we had a big property to take care of, and a lot of responsibility fell on me as a young adult from the time I was 13 till the time I was 20 when my father died. So this was the last year of my father's life. I was going into the last 6 months of his decline and more complicated medical needs, and I basically was his medical advocate because my mother was working full-time. And my parents were no longer speaking to each other, as you can imagine. So it was very stressful for me.
Yeah.
And I had asked for some guidance, some help. I just kind of put that out there to the universe, you know, like if there's some mentors or guides or somebody that can show up and give me some inkling of what life is going to be like beyond this and how best I can deal with the emotional difficulty that I was going through, because I was the youngest of three children. We were all almost 10 years apart. So, of course, my older brother and sister had flown the coop, had gotten married, had gone to college. They were all off running their own lives. Nobody was there to really support me. And I was just having, you know, like maybe what you might call psychological crises in how I can best be kind, generous, and available to my father's psychological, mental, emotional, and physical needs as he's dying, mm-hmm. and yet have him not necessarily be so friendly to me either in the process, which is something we learn more as older adults than we really have emotional possession of our capabilities when we're 19.
Right.
And most of my other friends were off, you know, smoking pot, taking LSD, doing Quaaludes and things, right?
Right.
And I'm like, I went off and studied TM so I could understand how to be present for this process.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what happened is, and this is going to sound very, very, very strange, but I think a soul group from maybe a star planet that I might be from originally as a
past life?
As a past life or as another species that's come here to incarnate on this planet to understand what life is like and what the challenges for humanity is like on this life. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of here as a vision provider for other species from other planets, maybe. And they kind of came back to tap in and say, don't worry, this is temporary. We're here, we know what's going on, and you're still part of us, and we love you. And they just kind of connected with me to kind of boost me and give me the strength that I needed, and also to increase my psychic abilities.
And this is what you got out of the hypnosis?
This is what I got out of the regression. I mean, I'm not describing exactly the step-by-step regression.
Right, right, right.
But this is the core essence that I retained from it.
Right.
A bunch of lights or spheres surrounded me. And when I looked at each one of these spheres, they were beings or personalities that I had known for millions of years, mm-hmm. millions of lifetimes. And I hadn't seen them forever. And I was like reuniting with these entities or these spirits.
I was going to say spirits.
Friends.
Your spirit
friends.
And their spirits, right?
Right, 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 right. And that's why I was weeping. I was sitting there weeping the whole time I was having this experience, and I didn't understand why, but I was literally being downloaded with an infusion of, I don't know what you want to call it, like overwhelming love or divine universal consciousness to help me be able to have the capacity to be present and not angry or resentful or rejecting.
Is this overwhelmed?
Needs at the time. I was able to be present enough to really love and communicate with my father and say, look, I've got a couple months with you, and if you want to spend it, you know, throwing judgment at me, that's your prerogative. But I'm here to love you and to connect with you.
Because
there was an age difference. My dad was 50 when I was born.
Mm-hmm.
So my grandfather was only 52 when I was born.
Oh,
so you can see my father and my grandfather were very close in age.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a big generational gap between my father and I. So when I went off to study things like TM, you know, Transcendental Meditation, he thought I'd run off with Reverend Moon, you know, and I was like following fanatics, and I was like, no, 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 Dad, you know, you don't get this. You know?
Jennifer,
this is the medicine of the future.
Unfortunately, we're running out of time, so give us your website again.
Of course. It's for the Travis film, it's Travis Walton. TheMovie.com, and my film production company is On Wings Productions. And for anybody in the Philadelphia area, I run something called Main Line MUFON. It's MAIN and then the word line, LINE, MUFON, MainLineMUFON.com.
Right.
They can come to free monthly programs, and I'd love to meet them.
Beautiful. Jennifer Stein, I want to thank you so much for being on our show again.
Oh,
and
sure.
There's a lot we didn't cover, so we got to do this again sometime.
I look forward to it.
Very
David.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you. And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on Talk Shows on the homepage, then Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is ufoimplications.com. That's ufoimplications.com. So please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 12 noon, when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. Until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
Hey guys, it's DJ Starlight here, the host of Listen Between the Lines. Join me every Tuesday, 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., where I will be playing all the alternative hits that might make you sing, might make you groove, but will definitely help you move through the week. Only on the station that is making waves, and that is WHFR.
Are you a local artist? Would you like to hear your music on WHFR? Please send us your music for airplay consideration. You can find our email and physical mailing addresses at WHFR.FM. Don't wait. Send your MP3s, CDs, and records today.
Enrollment is now open for Henry Ford College fall classes, which begin Thursday, August 22nd. For more information and to register, please visit our website, hfcc.edu. You can also call HFC at 313-845-9600. See you on campus!
Hope Village Farmers Market has partnered with the Michigan Farmers Market Association, a nonprofit, member-based, statewide association on a mission to advance farmers markets to create a thriving marketplace for local food and farm products. For fresh local produce, vegan food, children's activities, beautiful gardens, yoga in the park, and more. Stop by Hope Village Farmers Market at 14150 Woodrow Wilson at Oakland Boulevard. Wednesdays from 3 to 5 p.m. Visit Facebook.com/MyHopeVillage for more information. Support your local farmers.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
Guys and dolls, you are at the mall.